Eveen and Company with Eveen Ihuliwan on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning. My guests this morning are from the worlds of words and music. Their paths crossed on a movie set around the millennium and they've become firm friends. Colm McCann is from Dublin and is a writer. In recent years, his novel Let the Great World Spin won the prestigious National Book Award in America and the Dublin Impact Award at home, while his latest novel, Transatlantic, was long listed for the Man Booker Prize. He currently lives in New York. Paul O'Brien is from Donegal and is a musician. With his uncles, brothers and sisters, he formed the groundbreaking band Clannad. He's had a varied career in music as a performer and composer, and he currently lives in Thomastown in County Kilkenny. Paul and Colm have collaborated to create a song called Transatlantic, which features on Clannad's brand new album, Nadur. So Colm and Paul, you're very welcome to studio.
Hello, how are you?
How are you?
Dublin, Donegal, New York, now Kilkenny. How did you meet?
Obviously, I bet we're going to have different versions of the story, which is the best place for a storyteller to begin. Where did we meet, Paul?
I thought it was on the when the sky falls, but you reminded me this morning about meeting in the Pink Elephant
back in those fantastic years when you wouldn't remember where you were the night before, let alone like 20 years later.
Absolutely.
Down in the Pink Elephant nightclub there, many times we'd sort of come across one another. But Paul was always part of my sort of imaginative experience too, because I'd watch the band and I remember seeing them, for instance, on Top of the Pops and so on. And so later on, when we got a chance to work together on that film, When the Sky Falls, it was just fantastic. I just felt like I already knew him.
Yeah.
And is it different, you know, becoming friends when you're adults? Because generally you have those firm bonds of people that you grew up with, that you went to school, people who know where you came from.
It feels a lot longer. Or maybe going back to the Pink Elephant or whatever. But it just does feel like we've known each other a long time and we've seen a lot of each other over the years. And again, speaking about friendships, a lot of my oldest friends are from school and from things like that. But with Colm, it is a new friendship, however it feels like it's much older.
I mean, I don't suppose time really matters in these things. If you're a friend with someone, you're a friend with someone, and you pick up on something almost straight away, even if you haven't seen them in a year or two. I think that's what deep friendship is about.
Is it important, do you think, that you have that creativity in common? Because, you know, you're constantly creating in your writing, you're constantly creating in your music. Is that a kind of...
I think that's the catalyst. I think every time we're together, it's like... Sometimes they can be short, but they're very intense. It's like a full blast of what's gone on and what's going on in the head. And it's always like that.
That's interesting.
No matter where, whether it's here or in New York or in Paris or wherever we meet, you know.
Also the fact that you know, often I'm listening to his music in the course of writing, or the music has somehow influenced me, whether it be, you know, the early albums or the albums with Tara. And I listen on auto loop to albums, you know, one after the other after the other. And they become part, I suppose, of the texture of the language as it places down on the page. So the music then is sort of influencing the words.
So are you listening to music as you're writing then?
Yes.
Are you listening to Paul's music as you're writing?
Sometimes Paul's, sometimes it could be David Gray, sometimes it could be David Bowie, sometimes Van Morrison, sometimes, you know, Lisa Hannigan, like, or I could be listening to classical music. But sometimes I find the right album for the particular section and it really sort of works for me. That's with Transatlantic, that was the way too.
When you meet artists, they always talk about, well, this is really what I want to do next. Do you find that you kind of embellish each other's ideas?
We've spoken about this often. It's like, you're in the middle or you're nearly finishing something and it's already moving on to the next thing. And it's not the success of what you're at. I find that we constantly allude to this, that it's about what can I do that's better.
We've got a couple of projects that we're thinking about right now. One is As If There Were Trees, a little short film that we want to do with Gary McKendry that was originally written by our great friend Brendan Burke. And another film by Gary McKendry, who's a director from the North who got nominated for an Oscar about 7 years ago. Brilliant director. But it's called North, and we're a feature film that I can feel Paul's music pulsing through. It's about the Civil War, about two characters who escape from a prison ship in Civil War and walk across Northern Ireland through the cold and over the course of 2 weeks. And literally every time I read it, I can feel his music you know, oozing up out of the
Can't
page.
Wait.
Well, Paul, talk to me about that, because you won an IFTA for the soundtrack of Kings, that movie, but you're coming from a background of traditional music. So how is it that you were kind of able to break away from that tradition and then you moved to, you know, Harry's Game and movies?
The background is in Donegal is traditional. But our background musically is classical and jazz and contemporary, because we're all, Kieran Moy and myself, Deirdre, Enya, Leon, we're all classically trained.
So you learned in the house as you're growing up?
No, we were sent out. You know, my mum is a music teacher in her own right, but we were always sent to the nuns in Falkara and then further afield for our piano and to Derry for voice training. So very early, we were immersed in a classical side of music. And then with my grandfather and grandmother, they were teachers. So they were from Duchess. They were into the tradition and the words and the filly and all of that. So if you're going to how did I develop into making music for film, it was... with Harry's Game, it was handed to us in a plate almost, myself and Kieran, with that amazing film. You know?
And Colm, how about yourself then? Because with Transatlantic, which was longlisted for the Man Booker Prize, you've got a wonderfully rich story of Irish and American characters, and they're all intertwined across the generation and across the continents. Mm. Was it important for you to define those links between Ireland and America?
Yeah, I left when I was 21 and went to the United States and took a bicycle across the US for about 2 years, 12,000 miles on two wheels.
What possessed you to do that?
Just pure curiosity, really, and the desire to live things a little bit loud and live a little bit in a mad way, I suppose.
So at age 21, you're cycling around America on your own?
On my own, yeah. Sort of meeting people, coming across stories. And at that stage, you know, I stayed with Native Americans in New Mexico. I stayed with, you know, wealthy white people in Colorado, poor African-American families in Mississippi. And I began to hear all these different stories. And so I had the Irish... music from my own background. When I say music, I mean the way of living, the way of looking at things, because I think music involves everything. But then I was also getting this American music. And so now with Transatlantic, which is, 27 years later, I'm trying to put those two things together.
Were you looking for inspiration when you were going around with all these families at the time?
I will tell you that I sat down to write a novel when I was 21 and I came up with absolutely nothing. I wasn't even looking for inspiration. It was more a matter of desperation. I've got to get out and live my life a little bit and meet some people.
But that makes sense to me now, because, you know, when you read your stories, you've so many different characters, and it's often the underworld, like, right. You know, on the other side of brightness. Right. You've actually very rarely written about Ireland.
That's right.
So was that an important decision for you to make now?
It was a form of coming home. In fact, I talked to Paul about this quite extensively as I was writing the novel. I would tell him about writing a novel and the difficulties. Remember,
yeah.
I was going through some of the difficulties, and he got the early manuscript and things like that. And he knew that for me, it was a sort of coming home, coming back. You know, even though, I mean, I'm home all the time, as Paul knows.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm home, we get together and we go out together. But I meant coming home in a deeper...
Certainly after the last novel, it was what needed to happen in a way.
Right.
It was brilliant.
Paul, what did you think when you got that manuscript of Transatlantic?
I got it in New York, handed to me. We went for coffee and got it and got words written on a coffee stick. And, you know, he's always given me words.
What kind of words is in?
That's funny, because I'd forgotten that the first time before I gave you the we sat out for coffee in Lincoln Square,
yeah,
Lincoln Center, and I had no notebook with me, and there was no napkins or anything around, and there was the coffee sticks, and we wrote down the words to what eventually would become, or some of the words that would become Transatlantic.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah. You had a coffee. I had a couple of glasses of wine.
While I was working.
And is it true you nearly lost the manuscript, Paul?
No.
Yes. Well, come on now.
Okay. Well, I was on a world tour, so I'm allowed. I tell you, you asked me what did I think, and you know, it's very difficult when you're a friend of a person when you're being critical. I found it his best work.
I paid him a lot of money to say that today.
And that he's getting better. And I didn't say that to him immediately. We didn't communicate for a while, and I came back to Europe and toured around.
And then you were back in New York and doing a gig. We had the chance to, yeah, to talk about chance, it. Yeah. And that's when we sort of decided that we were going to write a song together.
Yeah, the book is obviously an epic story and one that stays with you as well. But why did you decide to create a song then from it?
When I went actually in to record the album with my brother mainly, and we were writing melodies and stuff like that, and obviously I had, you know, taken the book into my heart, and I'd kind of really sat with it, and it was one part that spoke, and I remember talking to Colm, connecting with him, and I said, it's not the whole story here, it's Lily's story. And it was really the story of emigration, the story of freedom, the story of finding herself as a person. And that was what we zoned in on then.
Lily is a character who she meets Frederick Douglass, the great American abolitionist and slave at the time. She meets him in a house in Dublin on the stairs. And then she decides to emigrate, and she goes out to America, and she loses a son at war. And then she farms ice and she goes through this epic sort of life. And Paul was attracted to that epic structure also because it was about going east to west and all these things and getting back to nature. And losing nature and with all of these themes which are reflected in the wider part of the album. Then it actually came together very, very quickly though, because I was back in Dublin and he says, okay, you can come down to the recording studio down in Roundwood, right?
In Wicklow.
Or down in Wicklow. We got a 2-hour slot, and I drove down and went in with Ciarán and with Moya and Paul. And we started throwing words around.
When was this?
It was in May.
Four months ago.
The seeds were sown when we said, look, let's see if we can get something. And then there was a window of opportunity and off we went.
But the place, you know, down near Glendalough, in his little house, out the back, Ciarán's house, a recording studio. And you just knew the energy was there at that particular time. We could have spent 2 weeks on it. Yeah. But no, it was spending 2 hours on it. And then we had it in a CD driving back from Wicklow to Dublin that evening. And we kept throwing around lyrics. And it was great fun.
And what was that like, creating something in the space of 2 hours? It sounds like it was very intense, and I imagine that's very different from, say, Colm, what you're usually used to doing, writing by yourself. Was it different trying to collaborate with the O'Brienons?
It was different, and it was wonderful, and they were really generous, but it was also incredibly instructive, because like I would come out with a lyric and it would be wrong, and Moya would say, no, don't like it, but on we go. And she's brilliant in that way. Yeah, Paul's the same.
Exactly. It's to do with a meter sometimes, and it's a word that could explain a lot from Colm's side, but would mean nothing to Moya.
Was Colm a bit precious about the words?
We had a good words. However, mind you, before he arrived down, he had sent reams of notes. Mm. But having Colm there for those 2 hours, then it was just crystallizing it, and it was just making it the beautiful thing that it is, really.
To me, it was about like achieving that apparent simplicity. It's like a really good dancer or whatever. And you don't know what sort of difficulty is going into the appearance of such ease. And for me, I was trying to this sort of complicated, torturous way of getting a theme across. And then Paul and Ciarán and Moya, they say, hold on a second, let's go for the simple. And then I started to realize that nothing is actually simple, especially the idea of simplicity. And what I like about the song is that it has this sort of simple melody, but then when or not melody, simple lyrics, but they're honest and I think they bring out a lot of what the character is about.
I think we get her.
I think we should have a listen to it now. Right. Here's Transatlantic from Clonith.
I walk the stairs, I walk the stairs from the shadows alive. You fled. Then I walked the roads, I walked the road.
I will always remember that couple of hours just putting that thing together and feeling that there was absolute magic. I'd heard the music before. So I was in that privileged position that we were coming in to apply the lyrics onto a beautiful piece of music. And that was really sort of powerful for me and muscular, so we could get in there and get it done quickly.
Mm-hmm. Colm, you're from the south side of Dublin, you live in America, and the book is talking about the humanity behind the peace process through fictional characters and then non-fictional characters as well. You have a very direct connection to the North.
My mum is from Derry and she grew up on a farm in Garva, and I used to go up in summers, and I always felt very free there, believe it or not. You know, I'd go up, I'd see the checkpoints, I'd see the barbed wire and, you know, everything else that was going on. But I'd get out on the farm and I would be allowed roam from morning to night, being 8, 9, 10 years mm-hmm. old, and having that sort of freedom was fantastic for me. And then one of the things that, that bothered me in later years was you'd hear about, you know, the Miami Show Band, or you'd hear about Dr. Herrema and these indiscriminate bombings in place, and nobody was able to make sense of it. And I've been carrying those sort of stories around with me for many, many years. And I desperately wanted to write about peace and the peace process, because I think peace is harder to write about than war. It doesn't have the burnt out, bombed out buildings. It doesn't have the clack of the bullet down to the ground. It's something that has more air and airiness about it. And you what you want to do is make it real. So getting away from Ireland and getting back in to try and write about the peace process was really important for me.
I don't think either of you would have been directly affected by the Troubles, but say, what was the changes that you could sense in Donegal and in Derry at the late 60s and early 70s?
Just growing up in Gidor, we were, you know, inundated with Northerners coming in for holidays. I mean, Donegal was a holiday destination for the North. And in the 60s, it was both, you know, Catholic and Protestant friends. And they were, you know, they had holiday homes and stuff like that. But that changed. That whole early 70s, the Protestants stopped, you know, travelling in. And also so many friends and friends of family that we know that had tragedy, you know.
And how do you make sense of that when you're not quite living in the middle of it, but you know what's going on? You mentioned the checkpoints, Colm, you know, as you're passing through your grandparents, to go to your grandparents' house. How does a young boy make sense of that?
Well, that's the big question. I remember asking my father when I was only about 6 or 7 years old, what were they going to do in Northern Ireland? He said that they were going to take a giant knife and they were going to put all the people who wanted to tar and feather one another, all the people who wanted to kill one another, all the people who wanted to rape and torture one another onto a tiny part of the island. And they're going to take that giant knife and they're going to cut through the ground and they're going to float it out to sea where they could do whatever they wanted to one another and leave the rest of us in peace, which is a beautiful idea and a simple idea, but also an idea that confused me as a child, because I also knew that that sort of thing was not possible. The more I think about it, the more I like that idea, because he was talking about a moral separateness. But I spent a long time then trying to come to terms with all these things. Not that, see, I grew up in Dublin, suburban Dublin. My classmates weren't really into this idea all that much, but because my mum was from there and because it was so close to me, and little things would happen, like I'd go to football matches with my father in England and we'd be sitting on the bus going to watch Stoke City games, which is a whole other story that you don't want to hear. But he'd hold my hand and he'd say, okay, don't speak too loud. You don't want people to know where we're from. And you just would be quiet.
So you couldn't kind of show off your Irishness in England and then Irishness was different between North and South.
Exactly. And certainly not at that stage. I used to cycle my bike up as a teenager, go up north all the time and I'd sleep out you know, camp out for a day or two and stuff like that. But the North was probably more important to you, Paul.
Well, it was. I mean, I was kind of privileged enough, I think, with writing Harry's Game. I think it was at the time that we wrote that, in the early 80s, you know, we come through the 70s, you know, we didn't realise it, but it was like a hymn, you know, it was like a prayer into the Troubles, because there were no answers. It was a terrible time when people were looking for everything to try and get some answers to what was happening up there.
And what did it mean to be Irish at the time?
Great. But very, you know, if you're hanging out in London, we were hanging out in London making an album, and we were staying in a hotel like for 3 or 4 months, and the bomb went off. And I remember everyone in the hotel knew us for that day until we left, that no one wanted to talk to us. It was really sad.
But from my perspective here, like seeing them, as I said earlier, on Top of the Pops, seeing them push the idea of traditional music into a whole new realm, making it accessible and available, and that to me was thrilling, because it meant that I could maybe do the same sort of thing with language and with my own storytelling. You need people to instruct you. You get your voice from the voices of others, and it's not just necessarily, you know, from other writers, but it's from musicians and stuff too.
That's lovely that before you even knew each other, Paul was already an influence on how you were going to behave as a writer and as someone who's creating something. But Colm, you've said that it's more difficult to write about peace than it is about war, because there isn't as much crackling imagery that you can grasp a hold of. And yet at the same time, a great piece of imagery that pops out from your book is Senator George Mitchell finding the shower after 4 days of going back and forth over the words and the peace process. You wrote about him as a real person within that. Did that make it more difficult or easier that you had to write about someone who was actually there?
That's a good question, because in the sense, I sometimes think about it myself. What's easier? To me, I pay as much responsibility to my made-up characters as I do to the characters who are real in the world, because it strikes me that the ones who are made up, like Lily, who informs a song, is just as powerful as, or just as real as, say, George Mitchell or Frederick Douglass. And my responsibility is to them as characters in the book to somehow grab people's hearts not instruct them, but to allow people to think in a new and unusual way. So if I can write about the peace process and have people think about the peace process in a new way, then I've absolutely done my job. It's like a song, right? Yeah. A song inspires you to think something.
Tell me about our next song, Madam George, from Van Morrison. Why did you pick that one?
This is the song that really rattled my bones. At an early age, hearing about Madam George getting on the train, going up from Dublin to Sandy Row, and a song about a transvestite. How is it that an Irish singer is like breaking open all these borders, boundaries, and where does his voice come from? It sounds sort of American, but it's also deeply Northern Irish, and had all that poetry and swerve, and it was just that sort of song that when you're a teenager, it's like, oh my God, you know, the world is very different to what I thought it was going to be. It was a tremendously exciting thing to hear.
Well, let's listen to Van Morrison's Madam George.
Down Cypress Avenue with the childlike vision sleeping into view, the clicking clacking of the high-heeled shoe, Ford and Fitzroy, Madam George.
Well, that was Van Morrison's Madam George. Colm, you've got a piece of vinyl there in your hand. What is that?
Well, it looks like a frisbee. You're too young. Does it look like a flying object? I have a 45 of Clannad In a Lifetime with Bono and Moya on the cover. Do you remember these days, Paul?
I do. You know, vinyl's coming, making a comeback.
I know it's making a comeback.
You know, the new albums out on vinyl.
And Colm, where did you buy that?
I bought it years and years ago. Probably Dolphin Discs or something on Grafton Street, or who knows. What year was that?
1984.
So long before you were friends as well.
Yeah.
Paul, you and your siblings, obviously, and your uncles as well, were in Clannad, and you know you're on the road every night. You're going to all these gigs. You're traveling all over the world. Mm. You've got all these parties. So how do you survive spending that much time with your brother and sisters and sister?
How do you survive? Okay.
How do they survive him? That's the question.
Do you lose yourself a little bit?
People think you're doing all this part. You can't do that all the time. It's like a job on the road. You're a well-oiled crew on the road. They're maybe 18. I mean, when I left the band, I left them in 1990. That was probably the biggest tour that I had ever been on. We toured the whole world. We were, you know, charting number one in Australia, New Zealand, charting in the States, charting all over Europe. I think the album got to number four in the UK.
Why did you leave?
The album that I went out on was Past Present, and it was a retrospective album, you know, all the best songs and some new songs. And I just couldn't think of a better time to actually just stop for a while? Because when you're part of the band at that stage, we were touring for about a year and a half. We would come off for about a month and then record an album over 2 or 3 months, get released and go off for another year and a half. It was exhausting. And, you know, we had great times and we were, you know, seeing a lot of different places, mm-hmm. and playing in Yokohama or in Japan or in Auckland or in Perth or in Bremerhaven. You know, it's an honour and a privilege to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And singing in Gaelic, you know,
a great way to see the world, I imagine.
Brilliant, yeah.
But was your leaving the band a little bit like Colm's going off and cycling around America? Was it that kind of finding yourself and having that space?
Yeah, I suppose that was it. I think at that stage as well, some of my own work with Kieran, we kind of drifted apart in terms of the writing togetherness. I was living abroad and, you know, it was all kind of music by numbers almost at that stage. And I felt it was time to go on.
I think, you know, coming back to the band now seems so energetic,
yeah.
for you.
Yeah.
And why the new album seems to have such a power for me anyway. That you had that break, you had that time to think. You went into, remember going all that Chinese music?
I worked with in real world for like 5 or 6 years. I immersed myself, lived in west of England where I, in Peter Gabriel's idyllic studio kind of set up over there, and I produced albums and toured the world with Chinese and African musicians. And so that was like the 90s, and then got into film music and dance and theatre. You know, I just did a lot of...
So you have all of this world eclectic music.
Can I say this? It was almost like going back to school when I was spending so much time with all these indigenous amazing musicians. Ayu Bogada from Kenya, and Guo Yue from Beijing, and Toto La Mompocina from Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see some of these musicians playing and sitting and writing in the studio, I was in awe. And it was like learning again, just going back and saying, you know, this is what I would do if I had the chance again.
And is that what gave you the impetus to bring Clannad back together then, seeing that passion?
Look, I don't think I brought Clannad back together. Myself and Moya had a conversation about 2.5 years ago, and then we kind of approached Kieran again, because Kieran has asked me over the last kind of 10 years to sort of, do you think, you know, are you busy? You know, what are you doing? And we had a couple of attempts to see, and they were kind of, they didn't work out timing wise. But the last one, when Moya and I had a long trip from Donegal to Dublin, and in that trip we said, let's go to Kieran and see, is there something we can do? That resulted in the Christchurch show. We really enjoyed it so much, and then it just gave wings and legs to everything we've been doing.
And Colm, do you get to listen to Paul playing? Do you sit in a trad session, or do you sit in with the family?
I've been down Thomastown, like, yeah. Shaking coins and glasses and making sounds. And listen, my great crime in life is that I do sing, but I can't. Right, so I know all the.
What
all
song
the,
do you sing?
Oh, geez, I sing like Freeborn Man of the USA. I sing Raglan Road. I sing Carrick Ferg. I love to sing, but I really can't sing. I empty the room very quickly.
I know, Paul. He can't be that bad, is he?
He is not. He's doing himself a big disservice. However, he loves music. I mean, my love of words, but his love of music is fantastic.
I don't know where it came from. Like from an early age in school, when I went to national school, I had teachers who said, and I know all the old ballads. So whenever there's a session going on, I'm always sort of at the heart of it. I don't know. I just enjoy that sort of thing. But I've been down in Thomastown with Paul and been, you know, in the studio, like throwing lyrics around and things like that. Or when he comes to New York and we'll go for long walks and hang out. And remember playing handball and all sorts of things, and just the raw experience of life, just being friends, and then but also talking about ideas, and that's what I like too.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a friend and he or she is a an artist, and you can somehow clue into their own world, and then also make their world part of your own, it seems to me that it would be one of the best friendships. Mm-hmm. We actually came together largely through another great friend of ours, mm-hmm. Brendan Burke, who died earlier this year.
Before we maybe talk about Brendan, I'd love to hear a tune from you, Paul, if you wouldn't mind.
That's a really good thing, because I chose this piece I'm going to play. There was a little trip that we took to Achill. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Do you remember we sambaed across the Shannon? We had to stop. Every time we get to the Shannon with Brendan, we used to have to stop and samba across first, you know, and then go back and get the car.
But because it's so momentous, crashing
across the Shannon. We had to do the river.
But we went down. It was Gary, wasn't it?
Yeah, Gary.
And Gary Brendan, Kendrick. Myself, and Colm.
And Adrian Dunbar was involved and Paul Myler was involved.
Yeah, it was an interesting project. But I remember in the bar that night, and I'd like to play it
sometimes
to Brendan
happens.
As well, this tune, which is a song actually, An Rothu Rungarig.
When you lose a friend like Brendan that passed away earlier this year, does that make you reassess then your other friendships?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I was just thinking that as Paul picked up the tin whistle there and think about Brendan, you know, he went earlier this year, and thought, oh, you know, maybe, you know, there are things that come about from the losing of a good friend, and maybe, you know, myself and Paul and a few others will grow closer because of that. Because, you know, every time I've been home, I still call it Dublin home, six or seven times this year, and each time I touched down, I thought about Brendan. Brendan was a photographer, a filmmaker. He made Fish in the Slowbrack River, one of my early stories. Just a fantastic person. And we'd been friends for many, many years, and then you met Brendan through meeting me, and we became a family, right? Another clannad, if you will. In fact, Moya gave us the music for Fish in the Slow Black River. He also worked a little bit on When the Sky Falls, and
of course he did,
we had so many other projects that we were involved in together. And it's funny when you miss him. Can I tell one little story about Brendan? You know this, because you know the tradition of the coffin. And I'd been at Brendan for years and years and years to read Ulysses. I love Ulysses, great book. And he says, yeah, I'll do it next year. Well, when he died, at the start of this year, his partner Liz found a copy of Ulysses that he just bought at Christmas time. And he hadn't cracked it open, the receipt was still in it. And she put it on his chest in the open wicker coffin there in Fairview. And I went in, and I had an hour before people came in for the official viewing. And I sat down with Brendan and I said, to hell with it, I'm going to read some of this. So I read him a bit from the What Is My Nation chapter. But my favourite part was reading him all the naughty bits from Molly's soliloquy. And I wrote a bit for the hospice recently, said that I wanted to send Brendan off with a big smile on his face. why not give him some of the dirty bits from Ulysses?
Was it important to have that time with him, Colm, by yourself?
Yeah, I didn't think so. I didn't like that idea before, but having that little bit of time actually was extraordinarily important. And most of the time you hope that you say everything to your friends that you possibly can when they're living. And with Brendan, I generally did. But there was that little thing where I'd always been at him, go on, you got to read Ulysses, mm-hmm. you got to stretch yourself. And literally he was 50 years old and he just bought it. And I know he was going to read it. So I said, I'll read a bit of it for him anyway.
He's very young to have passed away. Does that make you kind of reassess that you're living so far away in New York? Because you said you've been back and forth so many times since.
I don't really believe in emigration so much anymore. I don't think that we leave in the same way that we used to leave. The more difficult thing is the problem of return, you know, because you can't come back to the country that doesn't really exist anymore. But, you know, I can wake up in the morning and I can listen to RT. I can read my Irish Times on the internet. You know, I can Skype with my, you know, my mother and father. Who are
and do
still
you
here,
do all
you know?
That?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So you feel like you're
flight and be over here within 12
within a few
hours,
hours. So you can be in both places at once. There is still, I mean, I have to admit, there is still a sort of what I call the saudade, that Portuguese word for longing, and absence. You know that mm-hmm. It's not so much nostalgia nor homesickness, but it's just that little part of you that's longing to go home. But part of me thinks that we also do that in order to be able to remember as well. I don't know. How do you feel about? Well, you've always been here more or less. You spent a few years away, right?
I feel like I've got the travelling gene. I could go anywhere. I'm still haven't finished travelling, you know.
And Paul, does Donegal still feel like home to you? Because you went to boarding school at 13 and, you know, you're away then for your formative years.
I feel
almost.
Like I've left Donegal when I was 12 or 13 years of age. I left it, but never did. You know, I mean, the thing is that with Gaelic, with the family being, my dad and mum being up there, I just have a sense that it's constantly around mm-hmm. me, even didn't matter where I am, you know.
And is it important for both of you to see where the other has come from? Because Colm, you said you haven't been up to Leah's pub, to Paul's father's mm-hmm. pub yet. Will that be important that you see where he comes from, or
I'm
is that
him today actually? He doesn't know.
No, actually, it doesn't. No, it's not important to me. I feel like I'm there. It would be a bonus if I got up there. I'd love to meet. You know, he's met my mum and dad here in Dublin, and actually, the parents are very important for us. You know, it's funny, you know, to be talking, and I'm basically 50 and still to be able to talk about one's parents. Mm. John Berger has this line, if I'd have known as a child what the life of an adult would have been, I never would have believed it. I never could have believed it would be so unfinished. Mm. And what I love about life is that it's sort of constantly unfinished. Mm-hmm.
Do you appreciate your parents more now that you're parents yourself, especially your father's maybe?
I think that's the first thing that happens when you become a parent, is that you realise what they were to you.
I like the idea, the phrase, I am the son of my son. In other words, you look at your children, not necessarily just son, but you become part of your own life by looking after them, and they teach you sort of how to live in a certain way.
What influences your own dad then on you, if you're saying that your son is influencing yourself?
Enormous. And I talked about my mum earlier, bring me up to Derry in the summers and so on. But my dad surrounded us with books. He was a features editor in the Evening Press. There were always words there. He encouraged me, brought me books by Kerouac, Ferlinghetti, Ginsberg, and told me at one stage, whatever you do, don't become a journalist. So what did I do? I went out and became a journalist. I mean, thank you, Dad. You know, we do these things. And you hear a lot of people talking about the fathers, but also then I never give proper kudos to my mum, who's quiet and always there in certain ways too.
And how about your own dad, Paul? Was Leo an influence?
He was an encouragement. He was away a lot when I was growing up because he was an entertainer. So he had a show band when I was very young that moved, and then he became a solo artist that went to weddings and performed at dances and stuff like that. So he was away, like, mostly during the week, most days, and at the weekends. But during the band era, I mean, we were surrounded by all sorts of instruments, from saxophones and double basses and all sorts of just beautiful instruments. I think the biggest thing from Leo, from my dad, is that he had a great way of encouraging you, a great way of making you believe. And his mum, even before that, who was a drummer in a music hall, I mean, they were just empowerers. They said, you know, believe in yourself. And my mum as well. My mum, she was behind. She was at home raising all of us, but she was also a great musical, you know, guidance.
Isn't it interesting that both of you have kind of followed in the path of your fathers then? Along the same route of writing, along the same route of music.
That's true. And I would tell my kids not to become writers. Would you tell your kids to become musicians?
Oh, my two girls are mad musicians. Oh, yeah, I can't. There's nothing I can do. Really? I mean, no, I will encourage them. I will ask them to diversify. But Aoife and Alana and Ember and Kaya, they're all very artistic. There's kids, nothing I can do about it.
Tell me, what's the next project for the both of you? You've enjoyed collaborating on Transatlantic. You've had loads of other projects that you have worked on together. What's next?
I mean, I would love if we could write an album together. That'd probably take a good amount of time and space, and we'd have to carve it away and go to the right place, maybe down to Thomastown or something
New Mexico.
Like that. Or go away, completely.
I think when you bring stuff home sometimes, you have to go away to bring it back. Sometimes when you're writing from the same place, it becomes, you know, it becomes similar. And
I know that this film North that we're working on with Gary McHenry, I can feel in my bones that whether it be 2 years from now or 5 years from now, it's the favorite script I've ever worked on. I think it's one of the deepest pieces of work that I've ever worked on in terms of its purpose and what it's trying to say about peace and everything, even though it's set in the Irish Civil War, set 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's difficult trying to find money for these sort of proper, decent projects. And but I know that this will be a nice collision because Gary McHenry, the director, he's a man who frames the most beautiful shots. And then you have Paul's music and hopefully the story that I've written, adapted from a novel called The Road to Ballyshannon.
Mm. And that'll be based a lot on the male relationships then as well, the men fighting in the Civil War.
Father-son relationships, a Catholic side, Protestant side, IRA, so on. And it's all about walking across the landscape of your own youth and your own hatred and recognising that your enemy is not necessarily always your enemy. The enemy is something that's deep within, and but it all gets tied up in the labyrinth of politics and, you know, important stuff for all of us to engage in. That's the other thing as well. I think we get a chance to engage in sort of, we live in important times, but we get a chance to engage in sort of important stuff, but we also have a laugh as well.
You have to.
You have to. Well, on that note, we'll finish with our last song. Tell me a bit about this one. It's from the Pogues. Why have you chosen A Man That You Don't Meet Every Day?
Brendan.
For Brendan again. Yeah, absolutely. He used to let this one go. And Brennan had a better voice than you have now.
Come on. No, but this is for Brendan. He was a man you didn't meet every day. And I think the song summarises a lot about the sadness that's inherent in the Irish character, but also, you know, that sort of
the
madness and the, you know. It's a song that actually brings a big smile to my lips when I hear it, you know.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much, Colm McCann and Paul O'Brien, for being my guests this morning. The book Transatlantic is out. It's a fantastic read. And Nádúr, Clonagh's latest album, is also out now at the moment. But me live at Gnom Cana and Toxin Shahogan, Shogheev, The Pogues.
So be easy and free when you drink and when me. I'm a man you don't meet every day. So be
Evening and Company on RTE Radio 1. Podcast the show at rte.ie/radio player.